Well, they're coming from the north, south, east, and west to join the Good Gang Express.
That, of course, is the voice of Steve Goodman. Mine is the voice of Rick Cogan. Welcome to After Hours. One of the most, not only fascinating, but important books that has recently come across my desk, and I devoured it for a variety of reasons, called Compliments of Chicago Hoods, Chicago Street Gang Art and Culture. It is one of the most comprehensive, sort of anthropological, historical looks at what most of us, most of you, think of as a subculture, but a subculture that has been around for roughly 100 years. It is the work of two incredibly talented authors, I gotta tell you. And James O'Connor, whose nickname is Jinx, and I'll ask him why, is sitting here. He lives in Chicago, has always lived in Chicago. And Damon Corrado, whose nickname is Mr. C. That's like too simple a nickname, Damon. Damon is on the phone from where? Are you in Brooklyn?
Yes, sir. I'm in Brooklyn.
No, you don't have to call me sir. This
Greenpoint.
Okay. This book is the culmination not only of 5 years of incredibly hard collaborative work between you, Damon, and James, but of two lifelong fascinations with gang culture. James, let me ask you first. You grew up in Riverside.
Yes, sir.
You don't have to call me sir either. I feel like I'm a police sergeant in an interrogation room. Knock it off, guy.
I was looking for the ink pad.
And you, all of a sudden, people started moving out to Riverside from the city, families. And in those families, there were mothers that were telling their young kids, get rid of all that gang stuff. That's basically how you first learned about the gang culture in the city, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I remember even as a little kid, I remember the kids that were moving into my neighborhood were always talking about, when I grow up, I'm going to be a noble knight, or I'm going to be a gay lord, or I'm going to be, you know, and these were all different kids that were moving in around the neighborhood. So,
and you sort of realized that the reason they were moving in is because their parents wanted them out of that kind of gang life that existed in the city at that time, right?
Yeah, well, not at that age. I'm talking 7, 8, 9, you know, 9 years old.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later that I started to realize, and I was starting to get more in tune with, you know, what was going on in the news and things like that.
And you realize there was this thing called a gang culture in Chicago, which you two guys have just have done an incredible job of detailing. Damon, you started seeing, if I'm not mistaken, growing up on the north side in Lincoln Square and that neighborhood, you started seeing, you know, gang murals on walls as you were walking to and from grammar school. Is that right?
Yes, I grew up in the Ravenswood neighborhood, and I would see all of this. I mean, Chicago, as you know, was very different back in the 80s.
Oh, no question.
It was still a very working class city.
Yes, it was, and it certainly is not anymore. That's for sure.
Oh no, it's not. So there were gangs all over the place. There was gang graffiti everywhere, and for some reason, I've always been artistically inclined, you might say, and I don't know if it was because of that, but for some reason, the iconography of these different gangs that I would see as I was just walking around everywhere, really, it really struck me. It really impacted me for some reason.
And you used to, sorry. I mean, you'd go to class and then you'd start trying to replicate these kind of things in your, like, seventh grade notebook, right? The swords and the daggers. Yeah, go ahead.
Very struck by the imagery as well as the tagging style. yeah. at that time. Everything was based on Old English.
Yeah.
Or black letter. And it was just the most beautiful lettering that I'd ever seen. And so I would copy it. I would copy the emblems and all that. And at the same time, on the playground, you're hearing about things like the folks and the people and how that's starting up. And I'm watching the El Rukins on television.
Yeah,
you know,
and the
like
raid on
19.
The El Rukins headquarters, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm seeing these guys with these uniforms, and you know, like the whole thing just really captured my imagination at that time.
Well, then you're both kids, you and James, but you still, this fascination lingers for both of you, doesn't it? James, you later become a guardian angel, but even after you're a kid, you eventually start going into the city. You got a job downtown, and you're riding the L back and forth from Riverside to downtown, and you're seeing more and more of this gang stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. At like 15, 16 years old, I'm riding the L, and every neighborhood I would pass through, there would be a different gang, a different emblem. And it got to the point where every time I would get on the L, now I'm starting to know whose neighborhood is whose just by, you know, just by which L stop I'm passing. And that fascinated me too.
So Damon, when do you are a writer and an actor, and eventually you leave Chicago to go to, Greenpoint. When did your fascination with this stuff wane sometime after grammar school, and then you got refascinated,
well,
so to speak?
I sort of moved out of that neighborhood. I ended up getting into an art school and eventually moving out of the city itself in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So it did sort of recede into the background, but it was always kind of there for me. But within the past, I guess, now it's going on 7 years or so, several things served to reignite this interest for me, and I started delving deeper into not just the aesthetics of it, but the history of street gangs in Chicago, which is also kind of the history of Chicago itself.
No question. Yeah. No question. James, when did you start doing any kind of serious because I don't want to make the mistake that this book is just a series of interesting photographs and beautiful artwork. I mean, it's a really scholarly work. I mean, you trace these gangs back to, you know, I guess the most famous, tell me I'm wrong, you guys, the most these gangs, and it's all based on immigrants coming to Chicago and feeling out of place and needing to
yes.
bond with each other because, you know, if you're even, believe it or not, you know, no Irish need apply. So you had a club like the Hamburg Athletic Club, which was one of its most famous members, was a little kid who would go on to be the mayor of the city of Chicago, Richard J. Daley. You trace it back to that, but both of you agree that these, you know, I think what you're going to do with this book is shatter a number of misconceptions about what street gangs are. It is not all about violence. They first started kind of as social athletic clubs, right?
Yeah, that's true. Social athletic clubs.
Just ways to feel apart, because, and also gangs, and Damon, answer this for me. Gangs have always represented a kind of substitute for family. You know, as blue collar workers are out and dads are not. You know, there are no helicopter moms in the 1930s and 1940s, and dads are out, and that's basically it. It gives a kind of social structure to young lives, right?
Sure, sure. Gangs are so intertwined with the immigrant experience in Chicago, going back to the early 20th century, at least. People want a sense of community.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, of course, when you have a lot of these groups coming over, they're facing different forms of discrimination and disenfranchisement, and not to mention the segregated nature of the city itself, which is not just segregated not so much anymore necessarily, but was not just segregated along racial lines, but along ethnic lines.
Oh, no question. No question about that. We got to take a break, but you two guys are going to stay on till about a quarter to talking about compliments of Chicago hoods. That's Chicago, H-O-O-D-Z, Chicago Street Gang Art and Culture. The authors are James O'Connor, who is sitting here, and Damon Corrado, who is sitting in New York City. We'll be back in 2 minutes. For those of you of a certain age, and depending on your neighborhood, the book, a new book, Compliments of Chicago Hoods, Chicago Street Gangs, Art and Culture, will be not only evoke a million memories for you, but it will tell you a great many things you never knew about Chicago. It is the work of James O'Connor, who is sitting in the studio, Damon Corrado, who is sitting in New York. They both became fascinated with the, Damon especially, I think, with the art of, and I'm using that term correctly, the art of gangs, and James more so with the whole aesthetic of gangs and the symbols. And it is, gentlemen, I would say it boils down to, there were murals, there were compliment cards, which James has a huge collection, and there were these sweaters and clothing and emblems. This is, answer me this, Damon, I think the human need for self-expression is as ancient as cave drawings. Don't you think this is just another example of that, the need to say, hey, I'm here?
I do. I think there is a need within people to create. I think that everyone has an artistic aspect to themselves.
Yeah.
I also think that there's a human need to sort of bond together with people of like mind. And when those two things come together, you kind of have the sort of expressions that you see in our book.
Yeah, and they're remarkable. You were out in New York. You following a sort of visual arts path and a writing path,
yes.
And you got very interested in perhaps doing a book about white gangs in Chicago. And in doing the research, you come across my friend sitting in the studio, James O'Connor, who had started a website detailing that. That's how the two of you first began to collaborate. What was that like for you, Damon? And then what was it like for you, James? Did you say, wow, this is a like-minded guy? Because it's got to be a relatively small number of people who share your fascination. What did you think when you discovered James's early website?
I think there's a lot of people that are interested in this topic, but I think there's a small number of people that have the just sheer diligence and extreme dedication to it to go as deep as James has. So basically, I'm going deeper and deeper into this, and I'm realizing that there's just not a lot of material out there pertaining to the history of particularly Hispanic and European gangs in Chicago, post World War II. That is
sure,
and so I decided, well, I'm going to try to write a book on this. I'd never written a book before.
Me either.
And,
well, hey, if you guys, this is your first, you've set the bar pretty high, boys, I'll tell you that. But, and so you discovered,
you.
And you discovered James, and when
yes.
Damon
so
got...
I hadn't lived in Chicago for a long time,
yeah.
And so I kind of had to start from scratch, and luckily, through a mutual friend, I had the amazing good fortune to meet James. I mean,
well, the great thing about it, Damon, you're starting from scratch and you discover a veritable gold mine, did you not?
Right.
And James, right. What did you think when you had been thinking about maybe a book about the compliment cards, right?
Yeah, well, the compliment cards, we were going to put out. Well, my big vision was a photo documentary about the history of Chicago's neighborhood street gangs, and that's what Damon and I had, that's what we planned on doing. But then we thought, oh, we'll just put out a simple book about compliment cards first as somewhat of a primer or like an introduction to promote the bigger book. And then, shoot, what, 6 years later?
Right.
This is exhausting because you have not only is the book incredibly documented, there is a considerable amount of very first-rate historical research in this book where you take on virtually every... There are hundreds of street gangs mentioned in here, from very, very famous ones such as Vice Lords or the Black Beastone Nation, to the fascinating, the Gaylords fascinate me, the Playboys fascinate me. We're going to get into some of those specifically after the news, and I'm going to keep Damon on the phone from New York, and I'm going to sit here with James, and we'll talk about other stuff while we listen to the news and a couple commercials. We'll be back.
Time now to get back to Mr. Rick Hogan on 720 WGN.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking about compliments of Chicago hoods, street, Chicago street gang art and culture. It is literally a book that if you care about Chicago history and even want to know, most of us don't understand this town at all, even those of us who've been here for many, many years. I have a new understanding of and appreciation for an aspect of Chicago history. The authors of this stunning and deeply researched book, James O'Connor and Damon Corrado, they write in the acknowledgments here, I just want to read one sentence. Rest in peace to all of those who have passed on. This book is not a glorification of violence. Its purposes are purely historical and cultural. It was important for both of you, Damon, now sitting in New York, and James sitting here, to do justice to the people, because they had to, especially in your case, James, you had to develop a lot of trust with gang members. There are a number of them you've interviewed for the book. That was important to both of you, but it was especially important to you, James, because you've been on this trail for most of your life.
Yeah, it took a while. It took a while for me to even get up the nerve to start talking to people. Of course, it helped when I would be taking pictures of an emblem and somebody would come up and ask me, you know, what the F are you doing? You know, what are you doing over here? And, I'd explain that I'm writing a book, and either I'd get kicked out of the neighborhood or you know, somebody would offer to help.
Damon, in many ways, you have to appreciate, do you not, James's kind of courage in exploring.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're from Chicago, I'm from Chicago. We know, especially in the past, there are some neighborhoods that no one would go in, and here's this guy going in and gaining the trust of these peoples, I think, that enabled you to get a deeper understanding of something that attracted you as a young man.
Absolutely. James, I view him as some sort of almost like embedded journalist or a war correspondent.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I've never taken a journalism class. I didn't know anything. Here I am running around with a little 110 camera, you know, piece of crap. And, you know, just taking pictures. And I had a lot of opportunities that I missed because I was just too scared to push any buttons that was going to get me killed.
Well, but I think you guys and Damon, the response to this book, you know, it's also got a fabulous, you know, Anthony Hayden Guest, who has been a sort of social observer and critic for many, many years, has done a pretty interesting foreword to this thing that shows, I think, his appreciation for what the two of you have been up to. How did he get involved?
Anthony took an early and very enthusiastic interest in this. I was, it was sort of roundabout. I was recording a, Anthony writes poetry, although he doesn't call it poetry. He calls it verse.
Right.
And I wanted to do a kind of a hip-hop album with him. So we were sitting down and recording that, and I just happened to mention this project of ours, and his eyes just, like, lit up.
Yeah.
He was instantly fascinated by it. And he, at that time, was putting together a show that incorporated different aspects of street art and club culture and stuff from the 70s and 80s. So we ended up exhibiting some of the compliment cards here in New York. This was back in 2015.
Yeah.
And he's been a huge supporter ever since. And we'll be doing an event in New York at the Powerhouse Bookstore on October 14th.
James, you going out there for that?
I don't know if I can.
You better go out there for this.
Yeah.
You're a big part of this. I got to think, you know, in the book, Anthony Hayden Guest writes that, you know, he talks about New York graffiti artists and, you know, that whole sort of culture captured by Tom Wolfe in a New York Magazine piece entitled The Me Decade, because their motivation was to get me up on as many surfaces and many far from places as they could reach. In Chicago, though, it was not an assertion of individual will, but a gang thing, a turf marker, a declaration that we are here, and if you're a rival, you better not be. The nature of this whole thing, as we know, the city has changed. Would you both hazard to say that many of the gangs that once roamed areas that are now filled with sushi bars and craft cocktails have probably moved out to the suburbs and are doing their thing out there? James, you think so?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. You can look at the southern suburbs and Joliet, Elgin, Aurora. You know, people move to where they can afford to go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's unfortunate because while neighborhoods... And I love neighborhoods like Wicker Park and you know, Old Town,
sure,
where you're from.
Yep.
I love those areas. I love the buildings and all that stuff. So, you know, in some respects, it's good. But it really didn't do anything to solve a problem. It just relocated it.
Yeah. And I think, Damon, too, you make some great observations here, too, that the ready availability of guns, too, is something that has changed the nature of this subculture, too, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, that's another thing that we wanted to emphasize. Was
you
that
did, yeah.
It wasn't always that way. There was a certain code of honor and a certain, you know, there was a certain, a respectful attitude, I think.
Yeah, if you can't fight heads up.
Take the reader back to that time.
When I think the outrageous collateral damage that we're seeing when, you know, the kids, you know, some guy on South Austin Street, some florist got shot in the foot, and he was certainly not the intended thing. Ladies and gentlemen, you can read a story about these two fine guys and talented guys, James O'Connor and Damon Corrado, and their book in Tuesday's Tribune. I'll be writing that story. You guys, Damon, I'd like to meet you face to face, and I'd like to sit down with you and James and figure out how in God's name you formed a relationship that lasted for 5 years without killing each other. You have created a really, really, oh, I'm sure there were some ups and downs. You guys have created a really, really remarkable book. You can find it online.
I bet you he's got a voodoo doll of me.
Maybe he does. Right? He lives in New York. Compliments of Chicago Hoods, Chicago Street Gang Art and Culture. The authors use their nicknames on the cover, Jinx, J-I-N-X, and Mr. C. It is a pleasure to meet both of you, and I cannot tell you, as someone who is a lifelong Chicagoan and has researched this town plenty, you two guys really have opened my eyes into a part of Chicago I knew a little, but not a great deal about. Now I feel like I know almost everything about it, and you've done justice to the people you have mentioned in here. You have treated them with the respect they deserve. It's not always high respect, but you've been honest with them, and that's all you
never
can expect.
Never wanted to upset anybody.
Yep, and you won't with this book. Damon, pleasure to meet you on the phone. Congratulations on the book. James, pleasure to see you in person, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.
And we'll
great honor to be here.
We'll see each other again somehow. We have too many mutual friends. When you got your mutual friends are Bill Hillman and Tony Fitzpatrick, you're kind of bonded together forever. No kidding.
So.
Yeah, we will be. And great congratulations, and I hope you like the story Tuesday. We'll be back.
I'm sure we will.
That is the Phil Mitchell Band, and Phil Mitchell is here. I have only known Phil through his music. Some months ago, Phil, and welcome to the show, and how are you? And that sounds pretty good. You sent me a tune.
Yes, Rick, thanks for
And I listened to the tune, and I said, oh, nuts, I can't get it on this week, but why don't you come in and let's talk music,
okay.
Which is great. Okay, how did music come to you? How did you come to music? Obviously, one hopes as a child. It's not something you say, well, I just started playing yesterday.
Well, I grew up in Lilac Town, Lombard here.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking to Tony Fitzpatrick from Lombard.
And my dad taught at Glenbard East High School. And I used to go there, and Doc Severson used to play there years ago.
He did?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he was a friend of the band director.
Really? He was already playing for Carson.
And I went there, and the band director was really good, and he used to play a lot of the Doors music. I don't know if people know, but when we grew up here in Chicago, we listened to the Doors.
I loved the Doors. Look at, and James O'Connor is doing it, too. I love that. You ever see the Doors?
Oh, I never got to see them.
I saw them at the Auditorium Theater, of all places, when Jim Morrison was rolling around the stage, wrapped up in the microphone cord. So you were a rock and roll kid.
Yeah, I grew up the rock and roll. I had a neighbor could play the Boston songs, all the drum parts, and to perfection when I was a kid. And that kind of inspired me, too. So I was kind of...
What's the first instrument you picked up?
I've always been a piano guy.
Yeah.
And written everything off the piano and the keyboards.
You take lessons as a kid, of course.
Oh, yeah. 6 years with Imogene Olsen. She was one of the best.
The best Lombard piano teacher there was.
And she was a great concert piano teacher, but she ended up hurting one of her hands, so she had to quit professionally, but she taught me a lot about playing the piano.
So you in high school at this point, or what?
Before high school.
When does one, it always has intrigued me, because devoting one's life to music is a huge devotional matter. When did you kept playing, you were a piano player, did you start to play professionally or no?
Well, I used to play a lot of the Scott Joplin tunes, Ragtime, I liked a lot.
Really? Wait a minute, Phil Mitchell. You love the Doors, you started playing piano, and what appealed to you about Ragtime?
Well, I just like this, syncopation, the off-rhythm beats. And people, when I first was starting to write, I started writing classical music. My first
were
song.
Were you in high school or college?
I've been writing since I was a kid, third grade. But I, when I was went out to Glacier Park, Montana, I just visited this summer. I went to the old lodge and the old place I used to stay when I worked for the park, where I wrote some great classical music, and it was still there, and the piano was still in the lodge, and that's where I started with some great classical pieces out of Glacier Park.
Where did you study composition, though?
Oh, along the way, I've studied a lot of theory. There's just so much you can learn on your own these days.
Yeah, yeah.
And, playing with other people. But I think what's motivated me through the years is the creative part. You know, a lot of people pick up a rhythm and build off of that. I think it's the melody that provides the great tunes. When you build off the melody and just let it flow. And for instance, A Nation of Love, the song that
you sent me that I...
Oh, wow.
Why don't we... Ro, the incredible producer, Ro Coleman, in here with one of her colleagues from college, a classmate. Can you play Nation of Love? Ro has a CD, right? Or
yes.
Some kind of gizmo. So we can... Here it is.
Love.
Wow. That's obviously not you singing Phil Mitchell.
No, that's Penny Tay.
is she a member of your band? How big is the Phil Mitchell band?
Well, it's a lot of people through the years.
Oh. Oh, you mean over and over. What is it? What's the current configuration?
That's Penny Tay on vocals.
And, got a beautiful voice.
Oh, she's got a great voice. And she's kind of like a guest singer on the song.
Gotcha.
But, you know, there's some great people who have gone in through the albums through the years. I started out with Jack Musio, is one of the great Frank Sinatra singers here in Chicago. Does a lot of the Italian
fest. Right, of course. Sure.
And he did a couple songs for me. And Kristen Freelich, who's a singer at Drury Lane Theater in Oak Brook.
Yep.
Kevin Brannigan, a great guitar player, plays in bands here in Chicago. And Rex Carroll, just an amazing guitar player.
So when did you start the band?
Well, the band kind of evolved through the years, and it goes back to songwriting. We always talk about the classical rock groups, but we can't forget the songwriters. And I think I was one of them, you know, through the years. If you listen to the song Come and Stay With Me, for instance.
Sure.
You know, the energy that goes into the song. And I think that sometimes we forget the people that write the songs, you know, the people that were behind people through the years when they were coming up.
Are you talking about the golden age, the American songbook songwriters, or later?
Well, I listened to a lot of songwriters growing up, of course, Gordon Lightfoot, John Denver. You know, and a lot of them inspire me because they're telling the story. But I always kind of had my unique style, you know, which was playing the piano and letting it develop off the melody. For instance, a song we just heard where the vocals come alive.
Right.
Not just some riff, but, you know, the melody itself is bringing out the vocals.
But it seems, too, I mean, that just what little snippet I heard of that, and when I heard it the reason you're on the show, is it kind of is a combination of you know, contemporary and kind of classic rock. I mean, am I making too much of that, or is that?
Yeah, kind of unique sounding because it's classical.
James, but what do you think? I'm serious. That's powerful. Yeah, very. James is a musician too. Who wants to start his own band? Talk into the mic. What'd you think?
Oh, I thought it was beautiful, and I thought it was very powerful. And what kind of caught my attention was how the keyboards and then just the percussion just kind of blew up, and it seemed to bring everything it brought the vocals to life. Very powerful. I thought it was pretty fantastic.
The album Crossroads, which I gave you the CD for the album.
Yeah.
When people listen to that, they say they have to drop all their papers, do what they're doing, and the song just takes over. And I think that's the way I have of writing. You know, my songs have a way of touching the heart.
Yeah.
They reach out to people and inspire them.
Let me ask you, we got to take a break, and you're going to be on all the way till quarter after. But the music business is a hard business. I want you to think about this. You can answer this after the news. Because becoming a recording artist in this era is very, to my mind, very, very difficult. He's nodding his head, and he will elaborate on that answer after a couple commercials and the news. More with Phil Mitchell after the news, and you can go. Not, you don't want to listen to Roger Badish, but you can go to PhilMitchellBand.com. It's a very, very nice website. Thank you. I'm talking with my pal, Phil Mitchell, who runs the Phil Mitchell Band. He is... said I've been in love with music since a young man, and the Doors are what really hooked him. But he incorporates all manner of genres into his work, and he is a prolific songwriter. You also, however, Phil, write other things too, don't you?
Yes, I have a lot of creative gifts.
You do, and that's good. That's good. What else do you write?
I've written over 70 original quotes.
Wow. You want to give us some examples?
Yes.
These are all, I mean, you're a positive thinker about life and about the country and about the future. So I'm assuming these are sort of positive quotes.
Dreams keep us growing. Dreams keep us alive. To give up on our dreams is to let them die.
That's an original quote of yours?
Yes.
That's good, man.
History is not a bad thing. It's just a thing to remind us what to do and what not to do in the future.
That's pretty good, too. How do you, yeah, you can read some more, but I want to ask in the middle of this, how do you, what inspires you to write a quotation like that, or an aphorism like that, or a song lyric? What's the process?
Well, that history quote came from my dad, who taught world history and American history for over 30 years.
Wow.
He reminded me of the great past empires, of how they came and gone, and it usually was about money, and then things start to go wrong, and then that was the end of the empire. And I would tell my dad, well, that's never going to happen here in America.
Yeah, you've been watching the last few days. What's the matter? You've been watching the news the last few days? But go ahead, read a couple more.
Yes. The planet and sun in our galaxy are there to help support life on Earth. We are not just part of the garden that surrounds a living spring. We are just part of the garden that surrounds a living spring. It is life itself that is the driving force of the universe. It is up to us to help preserve this garden. So wow. I think the galaxy was created for life, and we can't see all the galaxies.
Of course not.
If we saw them all, we would see that all the planets and how they're interconnected were created there to support life wherever they are. And when we start messing around with life on this planet...
You've seen the Amazon rainforest burning down? Yeah, I know. There's some... You're a hopeful guy, though, I think. I get a sense.
Well, I tell the kids that...
He's a teacher.
We have to have hope for the future. I'm a believer. I was a winner when I was in high school, and I still believe that one day we'll be a winner in this country. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I think we all need a winning future for everybody. That's the bottom line.
When you tell the kids in your class that, and you in your confident way do, it must give them hope.
Yes. When I was at the school, you know, I touched a lot of the kids with the quotes and inspiring them and talking about dreams. And it's hard sometimes because when you talk about a species and survival of a species,
right,
you have to, you know, you have to make them think, well, how does that apply to us? How are we dealing with our environment? How are we dealing with the national debt and the interest coming up? Are we ready to take it on? Are we ready to take on the major problems?
You should be a politician. Do some of your quotations work their way? I'm sure they do. They must work their way into some of your songs too, right?
Yes. Sometimes the songs themselves change a little bit lyric-wise. Huh. You go into with a song, and I would play something off the piano, and the melody would flow. And then I'd put the words to it.
Yeah.
And sometimes the words change a little bit.
Sure.
Sometimes they come off your stories. I'll never forget the time I was near the Tribune Tower, and during the summertime I'd be driving a trolley, you know, because I was teaching.
Yeah.
And this guy came on the trolley, and it fell backwards. I had two people on that trolley. It was right by the Tribune Tower. And they caught him as he fell. Now, they had to take him away to the hospital. Luckily, it was probably some heart condition. Okay. I said, my manager, he was fine. But the guy that caught him was a doctor, and the lady that caught him was a nurse.
Wow. Wow. Okay, life works in funny ways. You can go, ladies and gentlemen, to PhilMitchellBand.com to learn more about his music. He has three albums, which I still call them albums, or do you call them CDs?
I call them albums. Each tells a story. There was Morning Star. There was America. And then the recent album, Crossroads. Crossroads is an album about America, of how we're feeling these days. The songs speak to the heart. They speak of maybe a future that I'm looking at, I wish we did have. And it also talks of healing within the Crossroads album.
You're a very hopeful guy.
We have to move beyond the crossroads, Rick, to healing in this nation.
No, we got to move forward.
We can't make the crossroads worse.
No, we can't. I want to leave you and the audience with one final song. Ro has it up. What song is this?
Come and Stay With Me.
Tell me about the background of this song.
The song just kind of like comes at you. There's a lot going on within the song.
Okay, well, let's listen.
People like the energy in it.
We'll see about that, Phil Metro. We'll see about that. Come with me, there will be no more sorrow. Wow, Dan Long and I are totally taken with this song. The great engineer here. That's a great tune.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
What's been the response from people other than Dan Long and myself? I mean, people must love that tune.
Oh, they love it a lot. It's the energy in the song.
And oh, tremendous. It sounds, I mean, the thing about it, Dan said, I know I've heard this song somewhere before. I mean, you know, the radio station don't play original tunes as much as they used to. What is it like for you to perform live?
It's a great feeling to perform live, to get in front of an audience, and, you know, to bring out the songs to
Yeah. Wow. You are something, Phil Mitchell. You can. He doesn't have any concerts coming up, but you can certainly avail yourself of his three CDs and a couple of books. You heard some of his quotations. They are original quotes that about life, and I think about hope, and I think also about understanding. I'm sure you're a great teacher of whatever kids you're teaching in the Chicago public school system, Phil Mitchell, and it's an ongoing treat to know you.
Thank you, Rick.
So safe drive home, and we may keep that song, play it some more. Phil, it's great to see you.
All right, good seeing you, Rick.
You
thank
too.
You.
Continued success. Go to PhilMitchellBand.com for all sorts of more information. You can order. He has T-shirts, for goodness sake, some of them with quotes on them. We'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk about the Chicago Cubs and Roger Badish's upcoming book. Okay, Get Real in the Morning with Larry Potash, Ramin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, and that entire wonderful, wacky WGN-TV morning news team weekdays from 4 to 10 in the morning. One of the most media-savvy guys and one of the most prolific, energetic people I have ever met in this lunatic business we are in called media, radio, TV, is Rick Camper. You're here now.
I'm here, yes.
Take that as a compliment. You are tireless, man. You really are. I mean, you and I have known each other for some time.
A long time.
Back in your producing days?
Yeah, 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you start in this business, Rick?
So I was Stephen Gary's producer back at the Loop 1,000 years ago. And I don't know if you remember this, but
Steve drinking in those days?
Yes, he was.
Oh, that's good. Yes, yeah. That's when I knew Steve, too. I know him now, but it's two different people.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But I don't know if you remember this. You and Dennis DeYoung came in one day and hosted a show on the Loop, AM 1000, for you filled in for Stephen Gary, and I was running the controls room. That's the day I met you, and that was like, that might be 30 years ago.
That could be, that actually feels like it's 80 years ago.
Yeah.
Dennis, God, Dennis, of course, the leader of Styx, and now yeah. Split from Styx. Dennis and I filled in for Stephen Gary. Yeah,
you don't even remember it.
I have Alzheimer's now. You may be getting older, but I'm ancient now. That's so funny, and you were producing that show.
Yeah.
How did you get into that end of the game, Rick? How did you get into radio producing?
Well, I went to college at the University of Illinois, and they had a great college radio station there, yeah. WPGU. And I just fell in love with the business. And Stephen Gary came down one time and did a live show in Champaign, and I met them and, you know, got my foot in the door through that eventually after I graduated and made it into a career. For 20 years I did it.
How long were you with them?
About 4.5 years.
What was it like?
It was difficult.
Yeah, I'll bet. Sure.
It was, you know.
And these are two big, you know, and you people listening know them too. These are two big and often cantankerous personalities. Yeah. I do like them both, but they are both distinctive characters.
Yes.
Was that a lot of juggling for you? I mean, that is really a bath by fire. Hi, I'm from the University of Illinois, and I'm dealing with these two jokers.
It was kind of like being tossed into the deep end of the pool. But they were, you know, they were super demanding.
No question.
But the thing about it, and this really taught me how to be a producer, in that when something went wrong, and they had a gigantic audience, they told the people on the air that they had an idiot working for them, and that was great motivation to not be an idiot.
Yeah, but the pressure must have been really something.
It was.
Yeah. So you moved from them to who?
To John Records Landecker.
Well, that's a little more calm,
yeah,
is it not?
It was. Yeah, and he was at the oldie station at that time, and I worked with him for 10 years, and we're still dear friends. And he wrote a book for my company. We wrote it together called Records Truly Is My Middle Name.
I like John a lot. I like his daughter, too.
Yeah.
The reason you're on is because I miss you. We're not going to talk about anything that you do. It's a good opportunity to have you on. You had sent me a copy of your latest book, Every Cub Ever,
yeah.
A comprehensive guide to everyone who wore the uniform from 1871 to 2018. And I thought to myself, frankly, Rick, I said, okay, every guy who wore the Cubs thing, I'll have a look. You can come on the show, even if the pages of the book were blank, frankly. I was charmed and delighted by this because, as you say somewhere in here, or you tell me, that you did not concentrate on the old, you know, the whole internet was Joe Schmo played with the Cubs from 1893 to 1895. He batted 316 with two home runs. His nickname was Joe Schmo. You were interested, and this is the charming thing about this book, and the reason that every Cub fan should have one is the anecdotal story nature of
the thing. That's the thing that interested me. So it took me about 10 years to write this. I had a website for a while.
Well, because it started it started out of your passion for your lifelong passion for the Cubs.
It did, yeah.
You started it as a website that just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah.
And you know, as the internet has become so overwhelming. I mean, it's so easy to find every single statistic you've never even thought of about a ball player.
Or cared about.
Yeah, or, you know, seriously, or cared about, unless you're some kind of weird gambler.
Right.
But that entails, however, Rick Camphor, a great deal of research that you had to do about, and I'm not, you know, here, for instance, Virgil Cheeves. This is someone you know, Dan? Dan's a sports fan.
Now, that sounds to me like an old-timey baseball name, Virgil Cheeves.
It very much is,
yes. Well, he played for the Cubs from, and I just picked this at random. I didn't look at, from 1920 to 1923, Cheeves was part Cherokee. In the politically incorrect 20s, his teammates nicknamed him Chief.
Right.
To be fair, nearly every Native American to ever play the game was given the same nickname.
Yeah, there were over 20 Chiefs in the early days of baseball.
And then you have, it also is embellished by these wonderful, not with every one of the players, but by historical notes. I'm just lucky enough to have found one with Virgil Cheeves. The historical note is, on the day comedian Fatty Arbuckle was accused of murder in the death of actress Virginia Rapp, Cheeves lost to the Cardinals 4-3. The game was called after the fifth inning because of darkness. That is a one. And anybody, the great thing is there are many people who don't know Virgil Cheeves and probably do not remember Fatty Arbuckle and do not remember what that case was about. That will open a whole new world to these people. But that entails, Rick Camphor, a great deal of research beyond what one would normally. What spurs that in you? I mean,
curiosity. It was wormhole after rabbit hole. I mean, I started, you know, with some of the nicknames, you know, like, oh, this guy's got an interesting nickname. Where does that come from? And I'd follow that information. And then one day I was reading about the Titanic. This sounds ridiculous.
No, it doesn't. Not to me, it doesn't.
And I thought, I wonder what the Cubs were doing on that day. And I looked it up, and I thought, you know what? I could do that for everything that happened between, say, April and October of every year between 1871 and 2018.
Well, believe me, that is one of the great charms of this book. I'm hooked on this page, this Virgil Cheeves page, because here is a Cub no one's ever heard of. I would be amazed if they had. Dan, I'm looking at you. Wearing a Cubs hat. Rocky Cherry.
Rick, I swear to God, when I started running
through my uncle,
obscure
Rick.
Cubs.
Rocky Cherry is my uncle.
No, when you previewed that this was going down, I was starting to think of obscure Cubs with unique names that would stand out, and Rocky Cherry was immediately one of the first ones I thought of. I was like, I wonder
He played for the Cubs in 2007, and as Rick Camphor writes,
relief pitcher, if I remember correctly.
And the
very
writing,
good. Very
and the
good.
Writing is also very good in this book. Blessed with one of the great names in baseball history. Cherry was a journeyman pitcher who pitched out of the bullpen for the Cubs during their playoff year of 2007. Unfortunately for Rocky, he wasn't around anymore when the team made it to the playoffs. He was traded in August for Steve Traxel. The other nice thing is you don't follow up on then he became a cab driver and an internet millionaire.
You know, it was the first draft I did of this, it was 700 pages long.
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, this is who's going to buy a 700-page book? And so we cut it back and we made it 8.5 by 11. It's a gigantic, you know.
Yeah, it's like coffee table size.
Right.
Paperback.
And so I cut it back. And I figured people just want the basics.
All right, we got to take a break. I'm keeping Rick here all the way to 11. We're going to talk more about this book. And I must tell you, people, I do not. There are a million books out there about the Cubs and baseball in general, and many are very good and many are really bad. This one is in the very good category and very unusual, too. It's one of those books you can just flip open at any page and find some strange player that Dan Long was once a fan. Dan Long was his only fan, the only Rocky Cherry fan around. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720. What? Oh, we got a break for commercials. Okay, here's some commercials. At the beginning, in the introduction to his book, Every Cub Ever, A Comprehensive Guide to Everyone Who Wore the Uniform from 1871 to 2018, a real charming book and marvelously researched in a way that, you know, for the reader, not just for the stat fan. Rick Camper writes that the book began as a quest in 2008. He also says in the introduction that he knows it is obvious to me that there was no curse. The real reason for the drought was pure incompetence.
Yeah.
If Mike Royko were alive, he would be sitting. He would say it's also racism.
Well, there was that.
There's that aspect. There's the aspect of Phil Wrigley being one of the last, if not the last, one of the last to think that Negro ball players would be good. Was this fun for you, Rick?
I had so much fun.
Yeah.
I've been talking to people about doing other, like, you know, every White Sox ever or every Bears ever, and I've actually hired people to do these books because I don't have the same passion for it that I do for the Cubs.
How did you fall in love with the Cubs?
You know, my uncle grew up on Lakewood,
is
right, you know, next to Wrigley.
Yeah.
And he took me to my first game when I was 5 years old, and I just fell in love with it. And that was, you know, you talk about the Negro ball players, right? That was Fergie Jenkins and Ernie Banks and Billy Williams. Those are my favorite players.
One of the other nice things about it is it is spiced with I'll call them sidebars, such things about nicknames, others had died while they were Cubs. Lots of Cubs have died young, but the following Cubs all died while they were Cubs. There's another fascinating, and I read the whole book. I didn't read every single one of
the entries. I don't think I've read the whole book.
Well, but you'd be hard to stump in some kind of Cubs quiz. There is a very interesting. Where is it? Is it here? Roger Badish has come in the studio while I'm looking for this stuff.
Don't ask me. I'm not an expert on the Cubs.
You are an expert on your own life, though.
Well.
And you are putting your life on paper for the publishing house of Eckhart's Press that I may have met and talked about on the radio before you even started Eckhart's Press and when it first started. What is it, Rick, and how has that been going?
So the press is going great. We've had...
This is an Eckhart's Press book.
It is. We have over 50 authors now. We have a lot of media types, like John Landecker and Joel Daly and Mitch Michaels, Bobby Scafish, Rich King. Chet Kopic was one of our authors. Lots of... You know, good novels. We do it all, but we're all Chicago based. All of our stories are Chicago stories.
What do you look for in a book? And you know, you guys, you and your partner, who I like too, you started in the publishing business when the publishing business was about as hopeful as the horseshoe business.
Yeah, well, you know, I came from radio, and which is, you know, not exactly the hottest new business, and my partner came from the paper business,
right,
which was also heading down the tubes. But we, you know, the last man on the sinking ship, right? So we really we enjoy it, and we were in our 40s when we started this company.
Wow. Well, and you've done incredibly good work. I mean, the quality of the product, and I still think, you know, when you started Eckhart's, it was those were in the days, and Roger, you feel free to join in, when the word was, oh man, everybody's going to be reading a book on a Kindle.
Right.
That has not happened.
No.
If anything,
it's going the other way.
I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. But from your end, this is, for me, it's mere anecdotal evidence of people reading more books on a bus. But from your end, do you find that to be
without
true?
Without question. Something happened about 2-3 years ago, and it started going the other direction. And now we sell way more paperbacks than we sell ebooks.
That's great. Now, Roger Badish, who was in here, who's had an undeniably fascinating life, is he is not in your stable yet because he has not. Has he yet? Have you delivered a manuscript?
I have a manuscript. We have discussed it.
Yes.
The Bible is already long enough. I am now in the process of editing my lengthy tome, which, unbeknownst to me, became lengthy because I was taking it chapter by chapter,
right,
which was the only way I could deal with it. And each chapter dealt with a certain job or point in life.
Era in your career.
Yeah, and that's the only way I could put together my memories because they were just scattered. You and I have talked long before I was thinking about a book.
Sure.
And you were one of the ones that, you know, strongly encouraged me, beat me over the head. If you don't write something, I'm coming after you.
I did that? Good
I
Lord.
Think if we I go back to the tape, we might find
Yeah, let's go to the tape.
Yeah, let's go to the
let's
tape.
Let's go to the old show where I said that. But, no, I know that because I do think you've had a fascinating career.
I've done a
and
lot
I don't
of
think,
stuff.
But I do not believe by any stretch that everybody's life deserves to be between covers.
Right.
And Rick, you must get entreaties from people every day, you know, that I was a, you know, I think my story of being a dental assistant would really make for a funny book.
Yeah, we probably get at least a couple every day.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, we are pretty picky about which ones we go with.
Well, but you two are also nice guys, and I'm sure you let people down slowly.
We do. Yeah.
You know, everybody does have a story to tell, but a story is not always, as is Roger's, a book-length kind of story.
Well, yeah, and I got carried away because I was going for detail, and that's one of the reasons why it took me so long to start with, because a lot of the details I had either forgotten completely, and so
had
as
to
I
make
wrote,
up. Well, that's good.
No, I didn't make it up. But as I wrote other details, I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot this. And so I would go back and add that. Then some of the others, I remembered the incident, but I didn't remember the details. So I had to verify, like a lot of stuff from Las Vegas when I worked out there, I had to go back and thank goodness for the internet. I had to go back and verify. Case in point, for decades, I never got around to checking a story my father told me when I was young, living in Evanston. We had a neighbor called the Bornsteins, and the father was a lawyer. My dad one day pointed through the back door, the back of our house, and said, you know, Sammy Davis hangs out over there every so often.
Sammy Davis Jr.?
Sammy
Jr.
Davis Jr. hung out at the Bornsteins' house?
On the Bornsteins. And I go,
wait, didn't
nah.
Bornstein played second base for the Cubs before he went to law school?
1876.
Yeah, I'm going to look him up.
All those decades, I'm thinking, he's telling me a story.
Yeah.
What would Sammy Davis Jr. be doing
in
a
Evanston.
House in Evanston, as fancy as a house as it was? So I finally, in researching the book, got around to calling his daughter, who surprisingly worked at the hospital where Bridget was a nurse. I called her up and I says, I'm sorry, I've never talked to you in all the years that we lived next to you or since. This is what my dad told me. Is it true? Yes, it is.
Wow.
He was one of Sammy's lawyers when he was married to May Britt, and they would come into town every so often, go out for dinner or a show, and the daughter would babysit the children.
Good Lord.
Exactly. I dropped the phone. I couldn't believe it.
I thought you were going to say, yeah, he was our chauffeur for a while.
It's amazing. She said, but he never slept overnight there, but he would come and visit. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. This is outrageous.
That's exactly the kind of story that sells a book. That
yeah, people I
remember
hope so.
From a book.
Exactly.
I hope so. So, and again, so that's what took me so long.
Yeah.
And then I just thought, well, I had to put everything down, and you don't.
No.
And Rick has been fantastic in helping guide me as I frantically send texts and emails to him about, I'm never going to finish this. I'm never going to get it done. He says, calm down. Take it easy. And a tremendous guidance. You were talking about how great these
guys
are.
I'm a big believer. They are.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I've heard from other writers, too. I mean, about Eckhart's Press and how they are nurturing and they are not... do not send them your grandmother's book of recipes tomorrow morning. Not you, anybody listening here. Yeah. But they know their niche, and they you know they want to make money for the author, and they want to make money for themselves, and they know how to do it.
Yeah, and you know who gave us the idea to start the press?
Nah,
you.
Yeah, I'm just an idea.
That's why. When are you going to run?
I once had this idea that everybody could have a phone that was really small that would be able to put it in their
pocket.
That's
the guy you got to get a book.
Yeah, no kidding.
The thing about there have been a lot of local publishers that have come and gone since you have, especially one I can think of who's been on this show and who's in big trouble. And it's a hard business because the whole marketing and distribution and everything has changed. Have you got any signings coming up for Every Cub Ever?
I do. I have one on the 15th, I believe, or the 16th.
Where?
It's in Mount Prospect at a soccer club out there called Green White Soccer Club. And I'll bring a couple of boxes out there. And if you'd like to pick up a copy, come by. I'll sign it for you.
If you go to Eckhart's Press... .com, you will find tons of information. You can also go. Rick's got like 8 websites. We're gonna take a short break, and then we'll tell you all of Rick Camper's websites. And because they're all good, man, they're all totally professional. And they're all good. And this, I gotta tell you again, Rick. This Every Cub Ever is, and I'm a Sox guy, but this book is charming and delightful. There's a story in here about Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. That is literally not quite to be believed. I'm going to have you tell that story when we come back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm reading an entry. One of the things about Rick Camford's fabulous, fabulous book, Every Cub Ever, are these modest little sidebars. It does have every single player in here, but it told in an anecdotal story fashion rather than, he batted... appeared in 23 games and batted 245. Who cares? He has things like the ethnicities of various players, the land of origins. And here's an interesting one on page 80. It says, additional entries. This is a frequent thing. If you check out Every Cub Ever feature at, and here's another of Rick's websites, justonebadcentury.com, you'll find several additional entries, including celebrity Cubs fans, writers, and bloggers. Under the letter D, you'll discover arch criminal John Dillinger,
big Cubs fan,
comedian Tom Dreesen, and restaurateur Grant DePorter. All are huge Cub fans. This is what I meant to bring up. There's also a heartbreaking story about a Hall of Famer beginning with the letter D, who was offered to the Cubs first, and the Cubs turned him down, something Marilyn Monroe did not. I never, ever, in my wildest research or imagination, knew that Joe DiMaggio could have been a Cub.
For $25,000.
What?
They offered him to the San Francisco Seals offered Joe DiMaggio to the Cubs for $25,000 in 1935. And the Cubs had, at that time, a very good outfield, and he was an outfielder, and they said, nah, we don't need him.
Phil Wrigley said, I don't like Italians.
And then he came back to Chicago twice in the World Series and killed the Cubs in the World Series.
That really, had you ever heard that, Roger?
Never.
Damn.
Never.
Dan, of course, was the one who scuttled the deal. but it is. The book is spiced with little things like that. And again, the fact that there are broadcasters, too, included in the list. There is no Billy Goat included in the list because Rick Camphor, I believe there was no such thing as a curse. It was concocted by wily newspapermen who needed something to write about. What, Rick? You were so busy. You're running Eckhart's Press. You've got this Roger Badish book to deal with that's coming up. Can you hint at some other upcoming titles?
We got a lot of stuff coming up. I mentioned that we've got people working on the Sox book and on the Bears book.
Well, the thing that the Tribune's been doing, this 100 Top Bears thing, has gotten an incredible response.
It's excellent. I mean, the thing that unites Chicago is the Bears, really. So, that we're hoping that'll be a big thing. We've, hired writers for that. We've got Roger coming up within the next 6 to 7 years. If he gets his act together. There's lots of other stuff coming up.
You're having a ball with that, right?
I am.
What about personally for you? You have another book?
You know what I want to write?
Brendan Sullivan, who another mutual, from great mutual friend of ours, wrote a pretty good, entertaining book. Have you guys thought of collaborating again?
We talked about it. I was at his 60th birthday party last weekend or 2 weekends ago, and we talked about maybe trying it again.
That'd be good because he's a big talent, too.
He is. We used improv techniques to write that book. Yeah. It was a very unique way of writing it.
Do you miss, even though you're Bath by Fire with Steve and Gary, do you miss this business at all? This business has changed so markedly, I think. And you do a podcast now.
I do, yes.
What is the podcast?
It's called Minutia Men. It's a show about nothing, the Jerry Seinfeld
Seinfeld-esque thing.
But we usually interview a celebrity every week, and we talk about, nothing political, never anything political. It's like an oasis in the world of podcasts. But we just did it because as you mentioned, I kind of have an itch, I did miss it. I did miss doing radio.
Well, podcasting is an interesting future. I mean, I don't think there's any question about it being.
I remember when you asked me that question a long time ago about what I thought the future of broadcasting.
Now you're going to tell me. Wait, now you're going to tell me that I invented the podcast?
This is unbelievable. You invented the podcast, of course.
A visionary,
a real visionary, the visionary with no money. That's what I'll always call myself. Rick, it's been an ongoing pleasure to watch your creative flower.
Thank you.
And this book really did. As I told you, I would have had you on if it was written in crayon and made no sense. But it is just, even for a Sox fan like me, it's just eminently entertaining because he senses a good story. You get it. You get it. If it's not a long story, it's a lovely, lovely telling anecdote. You have a very smart way of culling.
I had somebody tell me the other day that it's a perfect book for people that don't read, which I thought, is that a compliment? But I think what they're trying to say is even people that don't read will enjoy it. I think they didn't say it in the most artful way.
Yeah, well, I think there's no question about it. That's absolutely true, and it's something that every... Now, the only thing, if you get the Ricketts family to have it, have little kiosks of the book.
No, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
I actually gave a copy of this book to him. Yeah. And Mr. Ricketts had me come and sit down by his seats, and we watched the whole game together. He's been very supportive, actually.
He didn't say, "What do I owe you for the book?" No. Okay.
Well, no, he did not.
Well, I mean,
he'll get a bill.
Instead of selling the programs, like the guys out in front,
a
little stand selling the program.
Every cub ever. Here, get your every cub ever.
There you go.
Thanks for coming in, Rick.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
Love to the family, too. Roger, you're always here. Maybe maybe in the minutes you spend here chatting with me, you should be, working the book.
Time to edit.
We'll take a little commercial break, then we'll get some news and close off this edition of After Hours.